SA Commuter Radio is your South African connection, bringing South Africans together from around the world. Tune in to www.sacommuter.com and listen to some great content from South Africans, for South Africans, to South Africans all around the world. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and listen to the live shows on www.sacommuter.com between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., Monday to Friday. Live, love, listen. SA Commuter Radio.
Iconic South African is a world famous audio producer and engineer, as well as an author, renowned for the groundbreaking work with Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, The Beatles, Carlos Santana, The Stones, and Bowie. He's also engineered and or produced records for many other well-known artists, including Anthrax, Joe Cocker, Peter Frampton, John Mayall, 10 years after, Matt the Hoople, John Sebastian, Carly Simon, Dionne Warwick, and Small Faces. It is, of course, Eddie Cromer. He's joining myself and Noel today to talk about Woodstock, Blu-ray, and, of course, anything else that comes to mind. I'm Janine Preston from Anywhere, Anytime, and today's show is brought to you by Sapro, exporting home abroad. And joining me is Noel Johnson from RTL. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Eddie. How are you?
Hi, this is Eddie Cromer, by the way.
Yeah, not Cromer. It's Cromer.
Usually Cromer. In South Africa, it was Cromer, but it became Cromer when I got to America.
It's like Charlize Theron, not Theron.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, or Theron.
So
Theron,
Cromer,
right.
Versus Cromer.
Yes, Cromer.
Eddie, how are you today?
Lovely, thank you. It's great to talk to you. By the way, are you folks in Johannesburg or Cape Town?
I'm in Johannesburg. Noel's in Durban.
Yeah.
Durban, right.
Durban. Right. I'd love to say sunny Durban, but it's been nothing but cloudy and miserable for the last year or so. It's been terrible.
Well. And I'm sure you're just dying to talk about your favorite subject, which is Woodstock.
It's an item in my past.
I'm sure you've been overwhelmed with questions about your experience at Woodstock. How did you end up there?
In a VW bug. That's how I ended up there.
Oh, wait.
It's a bit of a story, but essentially I got a phone call I think a week or so before the Woodstock event. From the directors of the movie, Michael Wadley, and he said, you know, you're quite well known for your sounds and everything, and you do a lot of live recording, and you're working with Hendrix, and Jimmy is going to be he's the top of the bill. Would you like to come up and record it? And I said, yeah, sure, why not? I mean, everything was very casual in those days. Hey, just drive up to Woodstock, record a couple of bits and pieces. We thought maybe it'll be 100,000 people there. Not too bad, right? It turned out to be 500,000 people. Almost, it was a small city. And it was, the only way I can describe it is 3 days of drugs and hell.
Mm. Sounds like fun.
But it was sounds like a festival.
Well, it was the most unique festival ever. I think it was groundbreaking, and certainly it made a political statement as well. I mean, apart from the fact that the bands, a lot of the bands were young musicians who were just starting off with their careers, and this made a lot of folks. Like you mentioned, Carlos Santana. After Woodstock, his career blew up fantastically, as with Johnny Winter and so many of the artists who played there. It was a remarkable event.
I read, when I was doing some research on Woodstock, I read that Richie Havens, he played the opening set, and Sweetwater was due to play after him. But because they couldn't get to the festival, he played everything in his backpack, the entire repertoire of every song that he knew until they could get there.
Yeah, he had a bunch of stuff in there. Well, there's a funny story attached to the actual physical stage itself. If you can imagine, the stage is... there's the audience is up on a hill and sort of sloping down in a sort of a natural amphitheater towards the stage. And on the stage itself, the crew had managed to build a circular substage with wheels on it, and the idea was the first half of this circle, you had the first band, and behind that other half was the second band ready to go on, and all they had to do was turn the turntable and you'd have the next band ready to go. Unfortunately, they tried to make the first turn and all the bloody wheels fell off.
Oh dear.
So that's where the term the wheels went away, or the wheels fell off, comes
the wheels
from.
Fell off, yeah.
And where were you? Hopefully not under the stage. You were in front doing the recording.
No, I was not in front. I was actually behind the stage, about 200 yards, in the back end of a tractor trailer. I had a little space, if you can imagine, 8 foot by 8 foot. It had two 8-track, 1-inch tape machines, a small console, one limiter, I believe, and piles of tape. And literally, we would, you know... If you can imagine that 15 inches per second on a 1-inch roll of tape, you only have a half hour of time. So when you get to the 25-minute point, you would start the second machine, so you always had a crossfade for later on for mixing. But it was absolutely the most exhausting thing that one can imagine. We were up till 3 in the morning, and we started 9.
Wow.
It's great. We slept on the floor of the truck.
Well, at least you went in the water, because apparently it rained and there was just mud everywhere.
Oh, apparently it rained. I would say it was a deluge. And then you see the
I wasn't there, so that's why I said apparently.
No, it was a bloody deluge because, you know, Woodstock, it's upstate New York, you know, and when they get storms, they get storms. It's like, I don't know what it's like in Durban, but this is an upstate New York heavy-duty rain, you know. And afterwards, all the kids were just saying, yeah, let's take this hill. And they would just be sliding down in the mud because it became a mud fest.
Mm. Wow.
Do you think...
I have another last question about Woodstock, and then we'll move on, but I have to know two things. Why did Jimi Hendrix want to be last? Was there something that he... Because I know
he was always supposed to close the show. It was supposed to be Sunday night.
Night.
However, if you take into account the weather, the fact that instead of a band going on for 45 minutes or an hour, they would jam and that would last an hour and a quarter, hour and a half. changeover, you name it. And so if you take all of those moments, it just backs everything up. So poor Jimmy, who was going to close the show Sunday night, closed the show Monday morning at 9 a.m., which was really not a good scene. But he was magnificent. His performance is searing. It's just one of the greatest performances of his career. And certainly the Star Spangled Banner, that is imprinted into the brains of pretty much everybody who was there. And then the whole nation heard it and went, wow, this is quite something.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to ask you a question about that, because being physically present when somebody does something so iconic, how do you carry it through for the rest of your life? And I'm sure that you tell the story with absolute fondness. Was that always going to be part of the show, or was it just something that happened?
Oh, Jimmy had been using that to close shows for quite a while. This was the most adventuresome performance. He adapted the way he played it for the situation, and this was obviously monumental, and he knew it. And so he gave it everything he had, I think. Another iconic moment, if I may, that I would like to share with my South African audience, which is so incredible. I'm so happy to actually speak to South Africa live. This is very unusual and very cool. By the way, I'm writing a book about my life. It's called From the Other Side of the Glass, and we're very fortunate. We're actually going to make a documentary film about it, which is in the works right now.
Oh, wow.
But one of the stories I like to tell is the first time I actually met Jimi Hendrix. I'd known about him. Obviously, you're being in London, you know, it's 1967, and Jimmy had had two songs out. He had Hey Joe and When Cries Mary. We're all very familiar with him. I'm working at a studio in London called Olympic Studios, which was the place where I very fortunately got to record Jimmy and the Stones and the Beatles and other bands that you don't know of. But on this particular day, he came into the studio and was sitting in the corner. This was in January of 67, and it was bloody cold. And he was sitting in the corner all huddled up with a little raincoat on. And he wasn't saying much. The roadies bringing the gear, when they set it up, and he switched on his amp. And I was about 6 feet away, and I was running around setting microphones and doing my usual engineering thing. And he hits a chord, and my life changed in that particular moment. I have never felt so overwhelmed by the sound of an instrument and the person who played it. It was as if his whole being, his mind and his body and the guitar and the amp was all this one thing. And it felt like it came from outer space. It just hit me like a geostorm, you know, and the hair on the back of my head just went straight up. And I have never felt anything quite like it. And it altered my path in my life. And there you are. That's something I wanted to share with you.
Incredible.
And what were you doing at the time? I mean, you're obviously setting up microphones, but...
Well, we're recording an album called... Yeah, this was Are You Experienced. This was the first album we were working on. And it was great because I ran inside into the control room and started recording it. I said, hang on, Jimmy. And I started recording a few bits and pieces for him. I said, come in and have a quick listen. And he comes in and he listens and he looked at me and went, he smiled. And he ran right back out of the studio and said, well, try this. And then... it was like, who could top the other person? You know, we had this wonderful relationship of, if you could do that, well, I'll just try to do something better. You know, it was always about how do I improve what he's playing out there and make it even crazier or different.
And what was he like as a person?
He was wonderful. It's funny as hell. And he... self-deprecating humor. He would take the piss out of me and Noel and... Mitch and himself. Everything was fun. If it wasn't fun, what the hell is the point, you know?
Wow. My last question about Woodstock, because I'm sure Noel's got a few of his own, but he's the muso. If you were in the front of Woodstock, how did you get the bathroom? And I'm not talking about you particularly, I'm talking about the festival goers. Because from the pictures,
they have the porta potties.
Just a mass of people.
Well, they had porta potties around the perimeter.
Ah. That's our mess, somewhere on the pictures.
You didn't have to go too far.
and also, like, they didn't have, you know, there's a bunch of trees out there, too, you know.
Yeah. And there was
that
the river
as well.
That was
always a question I wanted to ask someone, was if you were in the front, how did you get to the bathroom?
Do you
I think the kids were being very inventive.
Eddie, do you think that Woodstock set the tone for how festivals in the future should run?
Well, it certainly was a benchmark. I'm not sure if they were going to be run like that. Certainly a massive festival like that, it did set the tone. You're right. I mean, everything that followed was either going to be as well organized or not as well organized. Mm-hmm. And we are aware of some of the festivals that didn't go so well, where there were riots, et cetera, et cetera. But it certainly, having a big event is still today, if we could do it, we can't because of COVID, but if you could, you would have Glastonbury, you would have all these incredible festivals still cranking.
Yeah.
It's a sad comment.
Why did you not get asked to record the soundtrack afterwards or to be involved in the production of the soundtrack when you'd done all the hard work?
Well, I think it was by virtue of the fact there was one person who was quote-unquote employed to do that, and they had a particular vision and I disagreed with that, and so it was fine. I mean, there was a lot of work that had to be done. In a way, I wish I had done it. In another way of thinking, you know, it's done. I have remixed a lot of it. I've remixed all of Jimmy's stuff, and it sounds a whole lot better. I'm very proud to say, because, you know, with modern technology, I'm able to dive into the minutiae of his sounds and what was going on there and bring up the very best, you know, using the latest digital technology and the vintage analog stuff, and combining those two worlds, you can get some pretty damn fine results.
I noticed that Rhino released a box set with you having reconstructed a lot of the concert tapes and sound, what they call them, soundboard reels. Hmm. Was that quite an exciting project?
I'm not sure which one this is. Do you know, have the title for it? Because I've done so many.
No, it just said that it was more than 60 with Eddie and Lee Osborne.
Right. Lee Osborne was the assistant engineer, and I was a senior engineer. And, yeah, I mean, we changed. In other words, I would be 8-12 hours, and then he would take another, you know, we would switch over.
Okay.
I don't have that box. I'd like to get it. In fact, I'll call my friends right after the show.
You should, because we tried to get a copy and they said they were sold out.
Eddie, the difference between live mixing and studio mixing, and I'm not talking about necessarily today. Let's talk about in that time. What were the biggest challenges and the biggest difference when you were like doing a live recording at Woodstock versus being in studio with Jimmy doing the recording?
That was a challenge, as I said. I mean, we only had maybe 12 microphone inputs, and you would have to try to figure out how to put a microphone between two drums to get a drum. Two tom-toms, you know, that sort of thing. I don't want to go too far into the technical side of things, but it was very restrictive. Only actually, on the 8-track machine, there were not even that many tracks for audio, because the 8th track was pulse tone for the movie to sync up to, and then you had an audience track, which also had some music on. So really, basically 7 tracks, if you can think about that in today's market, when you have Pro Tools and unlimited, you know, 150, 200 tracks if you want to. That's the restriction. So you had to really have your act together to be able to pre-mix a whole bunch of drums onto one track, a mono recording. That's the thing. If you can do that, then, you know, you were reasonably successful. But so later on...
How do you take something like that, when you speak about a mono recording on the drum track, and turn it into 5.1 stereo, for example, or surround sound?
That is very tricky. It can be done, but it takes a lot of work. You have to actually go in and actually rebuild that mono track and split it up into various frequencies and then send it. I won't go into it. There are many, many more interesting things to talk about.
Sorry, that's just my musician side coming out there.
I see there was an interview on the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, which was 2 years ago. The couple that appeared on the cover of the album.
Right. I saw that.
How were they chosen? I mean, like, the photo, did you get a bunch of photos, or...?
That was something I wasn't involved
with.
Which
is random.
I think the record company, which was Atlantic, they probably gathered photographs, and they had their department that does covers find something that was cool.
And that's how they did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that whole Woodstock thing. I mean, when it first came out, it was, I don't know, there was... The country was going through a lot of stuff, and I think the positive attitude of Woodstock, here's 500,000 people getting together, being very peaceful, and just enjoying music and lifting their spirits, and I think we need more of that.
I think that's what proved that music brings people together, and it has this knack of making things happen, and that's what Woodstock seemed to have done.
It did. It really did.
I see you wrote a book on called Hendrix, Setting the Record Straight.
Yes.
And you toured South Africa with it.
Yes, that was part of a thing I was doing with Shure Microphones, who I work with and helped design some of their mics. And they decided, hey, let's do a tour of South Africa. They had some friends who distributed the Shure mics, and we said, oh, let's sort of combine this. And I'll never forget, this was 1994, I believe. I had left South Africa in 1960, in December of 1960, and then, as you know, went to England. And this was my first time back since that point.
Wow.
And it was very emotional. I mean, you know, flew into Johannesburg and then flew down to Cape Town. Oh, just walking around the streets of Cape Town and Bredaar Street, and where my old school was, I used to go to Saks, South Africa.
Okay.
Saks Boy.
And,
okay.
The next Saks Boy, yeah. And
tell me, did you fly in with SAA? Tell me you did.
I try to remember. It's a long time ago. It's very possible.
I know.
I think we did. I think we flew from New York.
By Ile de Sol.
And then we went down to, I think, to Florida, and then I can't remember anything. Anyway, it was just, to me, a wonderful going back down memory lane. We stayed at the Mount Nelson Hotel.
Yeah. Which
was, I remember I used to, going to school, I was on the top deck of the double-decker bus coming down this one avenue, and I remember looking out the window and you can see Mount Nelson Hotel, and I was about 13-14 years old. I said to myself, one day I'm going to stay in that damn hotel, and it became a reality. I miss Cape Town.
And what other towns did you see, or did you just see Cape Town?
I mean, that was that's all we could fit in.
Yeah,
my brother and my sister were born in Cape Town. My brother's a professor of history at Trinity College in Dublin. My sister's a retired attorney. She lives in London. My dad passed away quite a few years ago. My mom, who is English, immigrated to South Africa in 1939 when war broke out. And she passed away in London. She was almost 101.
Wow. Wow.
And she got a letter from the Queen. So there's this lovely South African, British, American.
Well, that's why we were so excited to find you. We were on this journey with Woodstock, and up popped Eddie Cromer, a man who was born in Cape Town, and we were so excited. It was a very exciting moment.
It was. It really was.
Do you?
And you know what? If you're born in South Africa, or in wherever, particularly for me, for Cape Town, you know, there's something about it. It's in your blood. And I can find myself now, as I'm talking, I've become even more South African.
Well, hopefully you'll visit your local South African store and buy something South African, just because you can.
Yes, we will.
I was going to ask, do you, not obviously you miss your home country, but do you ever sit back and wonder what life would have been like if you never left, if you'd stayed in South Africa, compared to what you have done?
Certainly in the beginning, early 60s, I think, it would have been very tricky. My dad was quite vocally outspoken, and I know we were being watched, and it was very tricky for us to get out of the country.
Yeah.
And he had many friends who were in opposition to the old government, but there you are. That's a story for another day.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Did you meet a lot of the artists that you worked with at Woodstock? Because I see a lot of the guys that you eventually represented or worked with came from Woodstock.
Well, Johnny Winter, I was already just done his first album. Carlos Santana became a good friend, and I worked with him consequently. Joe Cocker I'd worked with in England. Jimmy, of course. There were a number of the artists I'd actually done some work with, and then after Woodstock, as their careers exploded, I got the calls, you know.
Wow. In terms of things like your Kramer guitar sounds, tell us a little bit more about that.
The Kramer guitar sounds, meaning the guitar tones that I get, or the guitar itself?
I was telling Janine last night, as a musician, I don't know how many times through Pro Tools I've used your sound banks as waves, emulators and things like that, as pads and patches and stuff like that. So I think where Janine was going with this was like, how did that actually come about, that your sounds, and especially named the Kramer sound banks and emulated amps and stuff like that?
Yeah. Well, so I was approached by this company in Israel, actually. They're called Waves, WAVES, and they are the biggest in the world for what we call plugins for the recording world. And this was many years ago, and we decided, okay, what are you trying to do here? What's the vibe here? And I said, well, if I'm going to do a series of plugins, they have to achieve three things. I want it to sound as if it's recorded at Olympic Studios with that type of sound for the guitar, with the sound for drums, etc., etc. And that's what we modeled it after. And we got an old tape machine. There's a thing called Kramer tape, if you plug in that. It's based on an old tape machine from Ampex that was at Olympic. Today, people love that thing, because they can plug in this vintagey sound to warm up the digital sound, which is kind of an anomaly, really, when you think about it. Yeah. But the guitar stuff was based upon the old Olympic equalizer that had a wonderful, incredible EQ sound to it. So I use it myself still today, and a lot of people do.
Yeah.
You want that guitar to pop through the mix, you just punch this one thing, and bam, there it is. It's got a unique sound with transformers in. That's what we were trying to do, is to emulate what analog sounds like in the digital world.
Well, I'll tell you what, us artists of today appreciate you very much for that.
My pleasure. There's more to come.
What is your journey from from Woodstock. What was your journey like after that? Did you have a clear direction of where you were going, or did it just happen?
Well, 1969 was a very busy year. I started building Electric Lady Studios for Jimmy. I was recording Led Zeppelin II, Woodstock, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So I was very busy that year. And I made the decision that once Electric Lady was up and running, which would be another 6 or 9 months, we didn't open until May of 1970. And that studio cost $1 million in 1970 dollars. So that was a lot of money in those days.
Sure.
But when it opened, Jimmy was so happy. He lived around the corner, because if you guys know anything about New York City, it's on a grid, right? So in the village downtown on West 8th Street, that's where the studio was, is still today. And Jimmy lived around the corner in the village on 12th Street. So I can see him now in my mind's eye. He's walking down 8th Street carrying the guitar. He's got his hat with the feather, and he's got the bell-bottom jeans on, and people nod to him. They're very respectful. They don't come up to him. He hits the buzzer on the intercom, comes downstairs into the studio, and he's home. This was his home. He loved that studio with a passion, because this was the first studio that had been built specifically for the artist, with the artist in mind. And this, he felt, when he walked in there, he was enveloped in this wonderful place that gave him the best sound that he had ever heard, and he was happy. The last 4 months of his life, he was extremely happy. We worked day and night in that studio, and it was great. So from 69 going through to 70s, and then for the next 4 years, I ran Electric Lady Studios, and produced a lot of bands. Carly Simon I produced, and you mentioned that was there. And after Jimmy died, it was, wow, our world looked like it was going to fall apart. But we all knew that Jimmy would have wanted us, the show has to go on, the studio has to go on, move forward, don't look back.
Eddie, we're going to have to take a little music break now, but when we come back, I'd like to talk, myself personally, I'd like to talk more about a lot of the other artists we worked with as well, and I'm sure Janine's got a few more questions as well regarding the rest of your career, and I know she's eager to talk to you about your book. So we're going to take a little music break, and when we come back, we'll get into that.
Okay.
I'm
the Rolling Stones, and you're listening to an interview that we are having with Eddie Kramer, world-renowned producer, and worked with some of the biggest artists in the world. Just got a message from Lauren listening in, and she says that she is having the best time ever with Eddie joining us, and Janine as well. Eddie, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the other artists that you worked with. And I mean, you worked with Led Zeppelin and Carly Simon, and you can name them, the Kinks and all that. Out of everybody you've worked with, who was the best vocalist that you've ever worked with?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Male or female, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Nah.
Oh boy. For sheer style, Jimmy, no question. He was not the greatest singer in the world, that's for sure, but, and he was very embarrassed about his voice. He, you know, I had to put three screens around him so nobody could see him. he was very shy about his voice. He thought he had the worst voice in the world. I thought he was a great song stylist. In terms of great vocals, Carly Simon, absolutely, you mentioned, comes to mind.
Jimmy Page?
In terms, I beg your pardon?
Jimmy Page?
As a vocalist? No. You're talking about Robert Plant.
I'm talking about Robert Plant, yes.
All right, Plant, whatever, you know that guy. as a rock singer, I would say Robert, probably the finest of the rock singers that I've recorded. I mean, he had a range in the early days that went way up. So many great R&B singers like Lena Horne and folks like that in New York when I was at Electric Lady. You put me on the spot there, but I think I'm looking at today's markets. I have found some young singers that I'm working with now in Los Angeles, because here's the thing with modern technology. I'm here in Canada, and I can work direct with my singers in London, England, in Switzerland, or in LA, wherever they are. And I found a bunch of young kids, like 21 years old, who are just amazing songwriters. This is the guy I've been working with named Michael Cimino. He's a 21-year-old actor for TV, and he's a great singer. And there's this whole bank of new talent coming up the ranks who are really interested in what happened in the past and take some of those ideas and incorporate them into something very contemporary. And I love that. I continue to work with young talent. I think that's most important. Young engineers, young artists who are just developing, and I help them with my knowledge, and I love getting involved in everything that's new. Because it keeps the brain fresh. The rest of me is falling apart, but that's another story.
I think that's the same with all of us.
Speak for yourself. I'm feeling great.
But in terms of your growth with yourself and within yourself, did any of the guys from Pop Idols or any of those guys ever ask you to be involved? Or have you been involved and I just didn't know?
I'm not sure if by Pop Idols, what do you mean? I'm not quite sure.
You know, Pop Idols, did they ask you to be involved as either from the engineering side, the producing side, maybe the X Factor, any of those newly blossomed reality shows about music? Were you ever involved in any of them?
I don't think so. I kind of avoided that.
I was just going to ask, are you a fan of these reality shows or not?
No, not at all. No, I really am not. I'm sorry. I find that my time I want to spend it working on my career, my contacts, all the new things that I'm working on now, developing recording studios in different places in the world, developing new products, new plugins, finding new artists, mixing. I'm doing tons of mixing right from my house. We just finished a new Hendrix record. I just did a Frank Zappa album. And as I said, new artists, up and coming artists in California and in England. It's my world is sort of filled with, okay, well, what am I going to do today? Oh, yes, there's a pile of stuff that we have to do today.
Yeah. Is your mixing disc still a manual mixing disc, or do you do it on the computer? Is it now all
it's done through the computer. However, there are these little satellite mixers, and I have one now. It's next to me. It's just 8 channels, and it digitally controls anything that goes to the brain of my computer. Mm. And so it's digital, but yet it still has an analog feel to it. So I'm mostly 95% in what they call in the box. I have a friend of mine who has a studio down in Toronto, and we hook up together. So all my old analog gear is sitting there. If I need to run the sound back through it to get that quote unquote vintage sound, I can do so. So it's really wonderful to straddle both worlds, so I get the best of how they sound.
And have you ever come across Trevor Rabin from the
I've never met him. He's an amazing guy. I mean, what a fantastic arranger. I was always very impressed with his work. There's a bunch of South African guys who did really well. Mutt Lange, Trevor Rabin, gosh, who else?
No, Seether moved over. Seether went over Parlatones, but they came back. Right. They couldn't deal with it.
Manfred Mann. Who else? Manfred Mann had a South African
Manfred
connection.
Manfred Mann, okay. Manfred Mann, I met him in London in 1964. And I built him his first PA system for the Manfred Mann Mike Hug Blues Brothers.
Wow.
And he taught jazz. He taught me jazz, piano.
Wow.
That's amazing. Wow. I didn't know Manfred Mann was South African.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Shows you what I know about music.
when did you work with a band like the Stones? And the reason I want to ask the question about the Stones is because did you work with them in the early days?
Yes. I started working with them at Olympic in 1966 when we just made the move from the center of London to Barnes, where the new studio was.
A lot of people didn't.
By the way, that's now Olympic Cinema. It's now called the Olympic Cinema. It's no longer a recording studio. But in '66, when we moved there, the Stones were one of our first clients. And I did the Between the Buttons album, the Flowers album, Satanic Majesties, and then in '67, I did Beggar's Banquet, with Jimmy Miller producing. Now, that was a great album because Jimmy Miller, who came from the States to work with the Stones, he and I worked together on Traffic. And because of the success of the Traffic singles, I'm a Man and all of that, the Stones asked Jimmy Miller to work with them. And he was their best producer, I think, without question.
Yeah. But okay, the question I wanted to ask is, obviously, the Stones are still around today and still working to a certain degree. What have
and
you
I have
seen?
To say, I have to say something. I have to interject because my heart goes out because Charlie, I thought Charlie was the most wonderful human being. Charlie Watts, God bless him, God rest in peace. He was an incredible drummer. But not only was he an incredible drummer, he was a gentleman and loved arts. He was a fantastic painter and drawer, cartoonist as well.
Sure.
But he loved jazz, that's how we hooked up on jazz, because he was he was basically a jazz drummer. And so working with the Stones, going back to your question, sorry.
No, that's fine. That was so interesting.
You never have to apologize. Your story is all amazing.
What I was asking, that you work with a band like that in the early stages, and you've seen them over 40 years to where they are now, 40 or 50 years. How do you feel about their growth and progression, or has it been something that you feel is maybe a regression to a certain degree after their high, as you know, when they were at their absolute peak?
I think the Stones have been wonderful over the years. There's been very few bad spots. I don't think there's any such thing as a bad spot for the Stones.
Yeah.
They've grown, and I have to say, you know, Mick and Keith, they keep their ears open to the ground, and they know what's going on. You were playing that track.
Miss you, yeah.
Now, that is, if you had listened to the Stones earlier, it had nothing to do with what they did was they just figured, okay, this is what's happening now, and here's how we can put our sound to fit with the contemporary sound. They never changed their sound specifically, just incorporated some of the new stuff.
And now, how much of a role...
It's a tribute to their imagination and their willingness and their openness to embrace the new stuff.
How much of a role does the producer play in that?
Big. Huge. Yes, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Jimmy Miller was, quote-unquote, the guy. He brought stuff out of them. I watched him work with them, and it just he was the model that I used for myself, you know, because when I wanted to become a record producer, I have Jimmy Miller in my brain, you know, because of his ability to get the band excited, help them write the song, help them do the arrangement, and he even play drums. You know, he was fabulous. So the producer's ideas, along with the band, you know, you don't want to hammer them over the head. You just want to sort of guide them down the path. You know, you don't want to sort of impose your will.
Incredible.
What is your way forward during COVID? I mean, you're obviously at home. You're helping everybody online. But after COVID, do you think you're going to continue working online, or are you going to go back into the world?
I think it'll be a mix, because obviously health is a big part of what is going on now. I can't go into a studio with a bunch of guys. No, that's not going to happen. My wife and I have both been double vaccinated, but now, you know, there's the Delta variant and all this kind of stuff, and I'm very, I'm going to be very careful about my next moves. I think if the studio has adopted the right protocol, everybody wear a mask, you know, you have to make sure that you've all been double vaxxed, then maybe, you know, I'll go in with one or two people, see how that works. But for now, it's all on the internet. It's all on Zoom and audio movers. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but that's how I'm able to be in sync perfectly with virtually no latency with artists all around the world. That's great.
That's amazing.
I do miss it. I miss the contact. I miss the one-on-one. I miss being in the studio with the band.
So that's the vibe.
Oh, I miss that terribly. But you have to find a balance, you know? That's like
what made you decide to move to Canada?
I had an offer of a job here in Toronto, and that was okay for a while, and I've moved on, and I have some other things and better things now that I'm working on.
But you're going to stay in Canada?
Oh, yeah, no, we just applied for permanent residency. Yes, we love it here. Healthcare system is great.
Is it a bit cold there?
He doesn't walk outside.
I have to say, where we live in this county, it's about 2.5 hours northeast of Toronto, going up the lake. It's in Lake Ontario. We had the best summer, 80 plus degrees.
Okay.
During the day, at night a little cooler. The winter time gets tough. There's no question. We get snow like 2-3 feet, you know. But you get used to it, you know.
You've got the clothes for the weather.
Oh yeah. You have to have 4-wheel drive, which is what we have, and you know, the streets are plowed. You know, once you get out to the country, it gets a little trickier. But the Canadians are tough, man. They've been doing this for a couple of months.
Janine, carry on. I was actually just going to ask about the book, but I'm sure you've got a bit more information more information than I've got.
No, it was about the movie, because you and I developed a movie, and yeah, tell us a little bit more about that.
It actually ties into the book. The book's called From the Other Side of the Glass, and it's my journey from South Africa all the way, many trips to London and back, and growing up in a musical household, studied piano, went to the South African College of Music, all of that, and then got into jazz when I was a teenager. I was listening in my bedroom in Cape Town, it was, had this little shortwave radio. So as you probably know, there was no TV in South Africa until what,
1977.
It's just, that blows. But anyway, I would listen to the BBC Overseas Radio Service, Voice of America, and on shortwave, you'd hear it coming. You hear the swishing sound. And that's what got me, years later, that's how I heard that phasing sound, which was very much like that. Yeah. But anyway, that's what I listened to, was blues, rock, Elvis Presley. And I got into a lot of trouble at school because I was banging away on my desk playing piano. Kramer, get to the principal's office.
The accent is perfect.
Love that.
So that's all your starting projects that are coming in.
I have to ask if there's anybody who was in my various classes at SACS from 57 through 1960, reach out to me through your station.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah.
We should have a reunion show.
Janine, you were going to ask me a question. I'm sorry. You wanted to know. So the book is all about that, coming to England, seeing the Beatles for the first time.
Did you see them in the cavern?
No, I saw them on TV for the first time. I mean, I blew my mind. That was in 62, I believe. But then I figured out what I wanted to do was to combine electronics and music, and I was working for this ad agency, and I opened up the TV yearbook, which showed where all the recording studios were. I said, that's it. That's what I want to do. And I closed my eyes with a pen. I went, wrote letters off, and I got one reply back. It was AdVision Sound Studios in 83 New Bond Street in London. That was my first venture into recording. And from there, I went to Pi Studios. And that's where I recorded the Kinks and Petula Clark and Sammy Davis and people like that.
Weird.
And then from there, I had my own studio. And from after that, that's when I got to go to Olympic in early 66 and came to America in 68, continued working, and here I am.
So you really traveled the world?
Fair amount.
And have you been to Australia, or was it just the States?
I went to Australia to work with
UK, Europe,
Africa. I went to Australia to work with AC/DC. That didn't turn out to be that part of the book.
Goodness gracious!
There's a lot of stuff.
That's an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, I took photographs of all of the artists I work with. So if you go to Kramer Archives, you'll see some of the pictures of Hendrix, the Stones, Zeppelin. All the artists I work with, I took pictures on. That's going to be forming a big part of the movie, is to take some of those images.
Is the movie going to be ready?
I think in a year, hopefully, 18 months to a year. We just got the final word that we're moving ahead with it now.
Okay.
Okay, big question is, who's going to play you?
Well, we'll put a little model there, you know. It's a documentary, though, Janine. It is a documentary. So, but we're hoping that it's going to be more than that. There's been rumors about a Broadway show of some kind. I don't know if that's going to happen, but we'll see.
How do you feel being like regarded like this? Because I mean, you've worked with the biggest stars in the industry, and yet you are also one of them. I mean, you're having a movie made about your life. It's like,
you know, I don't know what I call myself. I'm just a little old knob twiddler, mate. I just twiddle a knob.
I don't think so.
No, way more than it. Do you have a lot of dirty secrets? Do you have secrets? Do you have blackmail information that you can use, or is that policy or what happens on tour stays on tour?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if I dug deep enough, I could find it, but that's not my vibe. I don't like that.
No, we're just teasing you.
I know.
I think, I think coming from where you are, we're so proud to call you South African, and I think you should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. When is that going to happen?
Thank you. That would be an honor. Maybe you'll put my name forward.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. We'll vote for you. I think South Africa, a whole bunch of us will vote for you.
We'll get you a star on Hollywood Boulevard.
Do they have stars for rock artists?
Yeah, but they also have poor engineers. You know, Al Schmidt, who's a very famous engineer, worked at Capitol for many, many years. He was a dear friend. He passed this year. He was 92. He worked with Sinatra and everybody you can think of, and he was the nicest guy, genius engineer. He got a star on the Walk of Fame right outside Capitol, in fact.
Yeah.
My.
I just want to ask one more question because we're going to have to close very shortly, and I'm sure Janine will close for us. But my question to you is, what advice would you give a youngster that wants to pursue a career similar to what you have done in the sense of production and things like that?
Today you have to go to school. You have to learn the techniques. They're quite complicated. And you must be able to play an instrument. Doesn't have to be brilliantly, just as long as you understand music and can play a guitar or a piano or something, or read music or understand it, because that's the core of what we do. Yeah. I approached everything from a musical perspective. The electronic side, all the digital side, all that is secondary. If I love the song, if the artist is singing beautifully and can communicate that emotion with me and then subsequently with the audience, and I've captured it and make it sound good, then I've done my job.
Thank you. It certainly sounds like you've done your job over the years. Congratulations from myself, Noel, and the rest of South Africa.
Thank you, Noel. It's been really an honor and a pleasure, and I miss South Africa. Tot ziens. I see you all later.
Thanks so much, Eddie. It was such a pleasure and such an honor to have you on SA Commuter Radio. Thank you so much, and go well.
Live, love, listen. SA Commuter Radio.